Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. Welcome to the programme. Lizzie, we're starting this week, in some ways, continuing a conversation that we had on Friday, because it's been the rumbling political story over the weekend as well. The pressure on the UK to stop selling arms to Israel. We spoke to the human rights lawyer Michael Mansfield about why he's one of more than 800 lawyers who are calling for the UK to make this step. That conversation well worth a listen. But it's something that we now see in focus as David Cameron is going to the US to discuss with allies the strategy for supporting Ukraine. This is an issue that's going to come up in conversations there as well. Over the weekend, he said the UK's support is not unconditional, but it seems the Conservative Party has some difference of opinions on this as well, echoing, of course, some of the issues that we saw in the Labour Party earlier on in this conflict. Here is the Deputy Prime Minister, Oliver Dowden, speaking over the weekend.
The Foreign Secretary receives periodic legal advice. I can assure you, as a minister, okay, I'm constantly receiving legal advice across a range of issues. But what has not changed is the fact that he has not changed his advice to the business secretary in respect of arms exports.
So it's up to date.
But the manner in which some people are seizing on this issue and trying to hold Israel to incredibly high standards. Of course it's right that we hold Israel to high standards, but I just think there's a bit of relish from some people about the way in which they are pushing this case against Israel. We should think back to how Israel was on the day of that attack, the trauma it's still suffering. Of course Israel has made mistakes and made big mistakes, and we should hold them to account for that, but we are holding them to a very high standard.
So that was Deputy Prime Minister Oliver Dowden there speaking to Sky News' Trevor Phillips over the weekend.
Yeah, really difficult for Dowden there to criticise Israel in as stronger terms as David Cameron even. So it shows the divisions within the party on this. I think it's interesting that, look, if they don't stop arms sales to Israel, what effect does the tough talk actually have? You know, Israel is partly withdrawing troops in Gaza, but that's not kind of a step forward. Actually, the troops are resting up for perhaps a different fight with Iran or Hezbollah. And so Bibi Netanyahu just doesn't seem to be listening to the pressure from the US and the UK. Actually, his stance seems to be hardening as he becomes increasingly isolated, not just internationally, but domestically as well. And what was also interesting in that Dowden interview was he danced around why the government won't publish its legal advice on whether Israel is acting within the law, which of course would be crucial to this question of whether to suspend arms sales to Israel. So this is a government that's still tongue-tied, it's still divided on its position in this war.
Yeah, indeed. And look, this is something that is going to be part of the conversations, as I say, that David Cameron's having with international partners as well. Ukraine, one issue, but also the evolving situation in Israel. We know there's been problems too on the US trying to align its position and get support out of Benjamin Netanyahu too. So that foreign policy issue continuing to rumble on this morning.
Now, let's turn to the financial mechanics of the government and a person who's been key to the functioning of the UK's government for the past 21 years. Robert Stephen is a man you might not have heard of, but he's stepping down after more than two decades leading Britain's debt management office. In that time, he's overseen the biggest explosion of public sector borrowing in a generation, having raised at least £3 trillion in debt. And he's been speaking about his career to Bloomberg's FX and rates reporter Alice Gledhill, who joins us in the studio now. Welcome to the podcast, Alice. What exactly does the DMO do?
Great, thanks for having me. So the DMO is in charge of debt sales. So that basically means they raise money on behalf of the government by selling billions of pounds of bonds, which are also known as gilts, to investors every year. Now, as you mentioned, Robert Steenman's been in charge for more than two decades, and he's finally leaving. They're finally letting him go this summer. He'll be stepping down in June. Now, that's significant because it's actually an incredibly important job. So most people in the country probably haven't heard of him. I certainly hadn't heard of him before I started writing about the gilt market. But, you know, the DMO is raising the money that keeps the country running. And actually, I don't know if you remember, but he got a shout out from Jeremy Hunt during the March budget. And then during those two decades, he's acquired this huge amount of experience and wisdom. And I think you can argue that the job is more important now than ever when you think about the amount of debt that governments around the world, including the UK, are issuing.
Yeah, certainly. And look, it's something that's part of the ritual on Budget Day as well, as we have the speech from the Chancellor. And then later in the day, you have the Debt Management Office tell us essentially how they're going to raise the money that the Chancellor has just committed to spending as well. Now, over the time that Robert Steenman was in charge of the DMO, we did see this huge increase in the government's borrowing. Let's listen to some of your conversation with him about the challenges that he's seen.
Policy making cannot be divorced from the reality of the market. That's not me trying to be clever. What we see here is the market. The market is not something that you can bludgeon into accepting your point of view. It's the market's view that ultimately policy makers and politicians need to take account of. That doesn't mean that that view is invariably correct or is always the right one. It is just harsh reality.
A very prescient warning perhaps there from Robert Steenman as well about the importance of the markets to those making the big political decisions. It's quite a period of time that he spanned while being in this position, Alice. Talk us through some of the big challenges that he faced.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of pointed there to the length of time he's been in charge, and that means that he's lived through it all. He was there during the global financial crisis, during the European sovereign crisis, the pandemic, of course, and then the brief Liz Truss era, which was one of the most volatile periods ever for gilt markets. And I think to issue the amount of debt that he has done during that time is really, yeah, it's a credit to him.
In that amount of time in office, surely there's a blemish or two on his record.
I don't know if I'd call it a blemish. In fact, it's very hard to get people to criticise much that he's done while he's been in charge. But I would point to one auction that he did during his tenure where the DMO didn't sell all of the bonds it wanted to on that particular day and that particular sale. So it was the height of the financial crisis, cast your mind back to March 2009, and he made a decision, which is his right as chief of the DMO, to reject some of the low-ball bids for bonds. And he's always keen to stress that a really important part of his job is to make sure the taxpayer gets the best possible value. Now, it was a very volatile time for gilt markets. Lehman had failed 6 months earlier, like the UK bank, so RBS and so on, they were being bailed out. And the Bank of England had just announced a form of stimulus called QE, quantitative easing, for the first time. So it was a turbulent time and investors were trying to get their heads around all of that. So Robert Steenman said, no, like, can't accept these very low prices for some of these bonds. And it just meant that at the end of the day, the DMO was left holding some of the bonds that it had hoped to sell that day into the market. Now, as you might expect, the price of gilts fell. And Gordon Brown, who was Prime Minister at the time, kind of issued this statement asserting his confidence in the gilt market. So I think that just underlines the immense pressures of the job. Because, of course, it's not up to the DMO. It's not up to Steenman as to how much they're selling. It's up to him in terms of how they do it. And, of course, he's in the hot seat when things go pear-shaped.
Well, one moment, of course, when things did go pear-shaped was after the Liz Truss mini-budget. We had that meltdown in the gilt market. All of a sudden, we had to become experts in the bond markets overnight. This is something that, Alice, you asked Robert Steenman about. Let's get his view now of that moment in 2022.
I wouldn't be honest if I didn't say that I was, I'm sure like others, genuinely concerned, because the LDI crisis was clearly impacting on market functioning. And this is something, and I do think the Bank of England, actually, I'm not sure it's, you know, people criticise the Bank of England a lot, but I don't think it's received enough credit for the way it got through that period and the way it also assisted the market and actually the pension industry itself to get through what was an immediate classic, absolutely classic liquidity crisis. You know, it was straight out of a textbook.
So that was Robert Seaman speaking about the gilt market meltdown in 2022. Now, with someone who's been doing this job for so long, it must be pretty difficult to try and find someone to take over from him. Did he have any advice?
He had a couple of pieces of advice that I think he'd probably pass on. So one, I think, would be the importance of ensuring you have liquidity. So that essentially means you can find buyers for the bonds that you're trying to sell at any time. And I think there's various ways that he's done that during his time at the DMO. So, you know, once the gilt market once upon a time was this real sort of fringe market because it's just sterling. It's not, you know, euros, dollars and so on. And it was really only UK, UK pension funds who are buying those bonds. But it's grown hugely in diversity since then, which I guess is also a reflection of how it's grown in size. And Seaman spent a lot of time travelling around the world talking to investors about the gilt market, trying to get them to buy these bonds.
Quite the travelling salesman job,
he,
isn't it?
Yeah. I think he spent quite a lot of time outside the country. And he's been all over, you know, US, Asia, Australasia, wherever you can think of. And then I guess, you know, he also had this slightly sort of philosophical point at one point during our conversation. And he made the point that, you know, a market isn't just, you know, a load of numbers on a screen. There are people behind those numbers. And in some ways, it's very democratic. And politicians and policymakers ignore those views at their peril. And obviously, you know, in that first clip, he didn't name trust, but I think, you know, that was certainly his comments there certainly were in response to the LDI crisis that we saw in October 2022. You know, governments have to listen to markets because they need a fully functioning market. You know, you can't sell debt if no one's going to buy it. So you really need a properly functioning market.
Oh, Alice, that answer could be an advert for this podcast.
Advert for that job, to be honest.
No, but this is the message that I'm always trying to stress, how important the bond market is to policymakers, particularly at this moment in the Liz post-Truss era, and particularly for any politician fighting the 2024 election.
Yeah, I mean, Alice, do they know who's going to take over, by the way? Has the job been advertised?
If anyone has any tips, do you write in? We think that's going to be broken. Yeah, we think that'll come out pretty soon.
Yeah, and certainly a very important person for the next Prime Minister, whoever that may be. Alice Gledhill, great to have you with us to talk us through that fascinating conversation. I mean, this is somebody who those in the financial world know very well. It'll be quite big boots to step into for the person who takes over from this job as well, because let's face it, you know, they're the one that have to be the bridge between the big spending promises and the investors who are the ones who ultimately end up funding a lot of that government spending.
Yeah, and such a moment of uncertainty when you've had the same person at the helm for 21 years pick the wrong person, and what could happen to the debt market?
So Prime Ministers look very jealously at him and the length of time he's able to stay in office compared to the average, well, in recent times anyway, the average length.
Oh, the benefits of dictatorship, Stephen.
Prime Minister's term. Please, it's a stable public service job and very necessary in such an important role as well. So we want to take you behind the scenes of that part of the functioning of the government finances, and great to get those insights and his thoughts as well, I suppose, on what it's been like being at the forefront of public spending for the past 21 years.
Now, there's one headline this morning from a new piece of research that's going to be sending many people, Stephen, into a cold sweat. The Resolution Foundation says average rents could rise by 13% over the next 3 years. And that's on top of the rent jump that we've already seen since 2022.
Look, this is central to what may be the key story of the next election: housing and how much it costs. A subject that politicians will be expecting tough questions over on the doorsteps, but also big ideas. If you look at the Labour Party, for all of the caution that we've seen from them around announcing big flagship policies, building 1.5 million homes is the pledge he's been most sure on. And we've reported extensively on the Tory party's commitments in this area as well. The fight may well be over young renters, and maybe also trying to win over the bank of mum and dad too. Well, joining us now to discuss this latest research is Cara Petiti, who is a senior economist at the Resolution Foundation, who specialises in housing. Cara, great to have you with us on the programme. Can you just explain to us what who we're talking about when we talk about renters? What proportion of the housing market rents and sort of what do we know about them?
Yes, I think far more of us rent than did in previous generations. We know that it's far harder to get on the housing ladder. So a lot of people who in previous generations would have owned their own homes are currently renting. And we also know that social housing has really been depleted over sort of previous decades. So a lot of people who would have previously have had a sort of social home are also in the private rented sector. And that means that also people are kind of renting for longer into their lives than they used to. About one in five families with children are currently renters as well. So renting is really no longer what I think people used to kind of think of it as, which was somewhere for sort of young people who wanted some flexibility. It's now a sort of very expensive tenure type that lots of people are staying in for a big chunk of their lives.
Let's get the controversial stuff out of the way, Cara. Two words that are going to make Gen Z very angry: avocado
not
toast.
Just Gen Z.
Oh, well, I know you like it too, avocado toast, Stephen. But how much is this a problem of young people spending more on discretionary items than their parents? And how much is it that young people are picky about the house that they want to buy, so they're renting for longer?
Well, I think that the really big kind of factor here is really nothing to do with kind of sort of spending patterns between generations. It's the fact that house prices have absolutely boomed over the sort of 2000s and 2010s. So kind of house prices have massively increased, and that means that the deposit you need to get on the housing ladder is just much bigger than in previous generations. And over the sort of past few years, when mortgage rates were very low, it was the case that it was really just like a really big hurdle of getting a deposit, but then your ongoing costs would have been a bit lower. But now it's a sort of double whammy of still need a very big deposit. House prices are still pretty high, but mortgages are also looking quite expensive as well. So some real challenges for young people hoping to get on the housing market right now. And they're not tied to kind of spending patterns or changes between generations.
OK, well, thank you for dispelling that particular trope. Let's talk about your research. Why is it you expect rents to go up even further? Because they have been rising sharply for some time now.
Yeah, so we know that we've seen some really sharp increases in rental prices for new tenancies. So they've increased by about a fifth since the start of 2022. And there is some good news here, which is that we're seeing rental price growth for new tenancies start to cool a bit. So we've seen it sort of start to fall, and we'd expect that to happen as the sort of brakes are pulled in the economy with the kind of high interest rates, earnings start to fall. We'd expect rents to fall as well a little bit. The reason why we think rents on average are going to continue growing over the next few years are because lots of people haven't yet been exposed to those high market rates. It's a bit like if you think talking about people with mortgages, you know, mortgage rates might be coming down, but if you've not remortgaged yet, you're still going to see a big spike in your housing costs. Similarly with renters, if you've been in a tenancy over the past couple of years, your landlord's not increased your rent yet, you're still going to see those really big rent rises at some point over the years ahead. So we are going to still see rents on average for everyone continuing to grow over the next few years.
And when you've got people paying so much for rent and yet politicians talking about the importance of economic growth, these are people not spending money on goods and services or as much money. To what extent is high rent holding economic growth back?
I think it's a really important question because housing is really central to questions around economic growth. It determines whether people can move for jobs that might be sort of higher productivity or kind of better paid for them. And it's also, if you have kind of fast growing cities, which is what a lot of politicians are saying is what they want and what they want to drive economic growth, those tend to come with high housing costs. So if you want people that already live in those areas not to lose out from those high housing costs in those kind of areas of economic growth, then you need to be sort of thinking about kind of expanding housing supply as well in order to kind of deal with those high housing costs.
Is that the main constraint on trying to deal with this, is essentially there aren't enough houses in the places that people want them?
I think supply is a big, it's the big kind of policy lever that governments can pull. And we know that the number of homes per person or per family has been basically the same since the early 2000s. And in that time, obviously, the UK has grown. So like there is definitely a part to play for just building more, and particularly building more social homes. We know that lots of low income people are still living in the private rented sector, whereas in previous generations, they'd have a much lower cost, much more kind of stable social home. And as a result, lots of people on benefits and who rely on local housing allowance from the government are currently renting in the private rented sector. And what we've seen over previous years is that benefits just haven't been keeping track with private rents, meaning a lot of the most vulnerable renters are really out of pocket.
And when you've got prices going up, why are landlords leaving the market?
So there's a real kind of emphasis at the moment on this sort of exodus of landlords. And it is something we've seen a little bit. So about 40% of landlords don't have any borrowing or debt, but there are big chunks of kind of the landlord market who do have mortgages and will have been seeing those sort of higher rates make those buy-to-let mortgages more expensive. And so it might be that some of those landlords are selling. We think that effect is relatively small on the sector and probably isn't what's driving these big increases in rents. But there are probably some landlords who are sort of looking at the kind of cost of their mortgage and thinking it's no longer worth renting out the house and are choosing to sell instead.
Cara, we're in that sort of open season for policy now as we head towards the general election, as we're expecting it in the next few months. What other policies could help address this crisis, particularly when we think about renters? You know, politicians are turning up on doorsteps or being canvassed on social media. What should other ideas out there that could be adopted? More protections for renters? Would that help? Would price controls help? What could work?
In the short term, sort of a question of how do you deal with kind of supporting renters right now? And the answer to that, I think, is that priority should be the lowest income renters. So making sure that housing benefits and local housing allowance, which is the sort of support government pays to people to cover their rents, is increasing in line with rents. It's currently set to be frozen for the next few years. It was uprated this year, really welcome, for, like, good that it's now covering rents at the moment, but it's currently set to be frozen. So making sure that sort of benefit support is increased in line with rents is really important for low income renters. And also making sure that renters are more secure in their tenures. So the government introduced the Rental Reform Bill, which should take away no-fault evictions, which is a big part of the reason why renters are currently in quite an insecure position in their tenancies. So making sure that sort of continues and becomes legislation is really important. But I think there's a sort of bigger question, which is, why do we have this sort of big private rented sector? And why is it so expensive? And the answer to that is kind of the overall housing crisis that we're in. And the answer to that is probably building more homes and kind of expanding housing supply.
Yeah, exactly. So Labour's got this plan to build 1.5 million more homes. Have you modelled the impact of that on the renting market?
That's not modelling that we've done at all. In general, I think whoever's the government after the election is going to need to look at how you sort of turn around this housing crisis that we're in. We've had decades and sort of successive governments that have failed to tackle this. It is time for a kind of a long-term strategy on how do you expand housing supply. And that probably means looking at the planning system. It probably means kind of working out kind of how you build in the areas of highest demand as well. But that is likely to be a long-term project, but it's one that the next government really does need to take on.
But is 1.5 million about the right number to fix this problem?
I think there's sort of various estimates out there. It's not something we've personally modelled.
What about what sort of timescale when we say it's a long-term problem? I mean, could a two-term government fix this, for example? You know, is 10 years enough?
I think for a long time, housing sort of sat in the bucket of, like, this is just too difficult to deal with. And you've seen that for sort of decades. We've had these sort of rising housing prices outstripping earnings growth. Since sort of like 2000s, 2010s, and we're sort of still sitting with the consequences of that now. So it's definitely not going to be a quick fix. We know we've got some serious issues in the housing market, and that's why some of this kind of more immediate stuff to protect low-income renters in particular and to make kind of tenancies a bit more secure while we kind of work out and kind of sort this sort of underlying problem is going to be really crucial.
And if you are one of the young people who can't get on the property ladder yet, obviously you're going to get older at some stage, I look through the glass at our producer, what's likely to be the long-term economic consequences for one of these generation rent people?
Yeah, I think it's a really important question, because it's not just about kind of young renters facing high costs now, it's about people with children renting in the private rented sector, and also even kind of reaching retirement still with housing costs. We know sort of average kind of pension incomes in previous generations might have been enough to kind of cover kind of pensioners' costs. But if you also add sort of renting costs onto that, that might no longer be the case. So there's real kind of questions about how this affects kind of every part of your life stage.
Are there solutions from other European countries, for example, that we could adopt here?
So there's definitely a kind of a move. So in some European countries, it's much more normal to rent for much more of kind of your life. There is a kind of an argument that is the UK just has a sort of fixation with home ownership. But we also have a far less secure rental sector in a lot of the countries where people do tend to rent long term. So thinking about how we kind of improve the security of our rented sector, and particularly kind of getting rid of things like no fault evictions is really important if we're going to try and emulate some of those countries.
Okay, Cara Pratiti, a senior economist at the Resolution Foundation. Thanks for bringing us that analysis. It's an issue that, of course, we're going to be talking about again and again on this podcast as we get towards the election. So central to Keir Starmer's promises and such a fundamental problem here in the UK.
Well, look, and for the broader economy, it's an issue as well. It isn't just the UK that's facing these sort of problems as well, but it is something that is bound to be a central issue in the campaign. That's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by James Wilcock, and our audio engineer was Sean Guastamacchia. I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.